Now, since the head of Hermes was on each pillar, the Hermes were sacrosanct. That meant that however they were mutilated, perhaps some facial features were lopped off and parts of the genitalia, we won't go there. It meant that this mutilation was a sacrilegious act. However, given Hermes' attributes, god of travel, the vandalism was also seen as a bad omen for the Sicilian expedition, and the fleet was immediately put on hold. Again then, we see that religion goes hand in hand with Greek daily life. It always will. Second, this is the second thing that happened. Obviously, the profanation of the mysteries. This was a religious cult that took place at Eleusis, to the west of Athens. Everything to do with it was secret, and only those who were initiated in the cult knew what went on at meetings, hence the name Mysteries. It had the air of mystery as, say, the Masons do today, for example. Now, whether an outsider infiltrated a meeting of the initiates, thereby compromising this secret sect, or whether someone parodied what the initiates were supposed to do when they got together, is not exactly known. But needless to say, given the religious significance, the god would have been offended. Indeed, anyone who violated these secret cults was open to prosecution. There's an example of Aristophanes, who parodied some of the rites in this cult quite inadvertently in one of his plays and was brought up on charges for this. Today, we think of the humour and the made-up intrigues that are acceptable about many secret societies. Think of Monty Python's Spot the Mason sketch, or of course the Da Vinci Code and its sinister portrayal of the Knights Templar and Opus Dei. But there was no similar toleration in ancient Greece. Although there was no evidence against him, Alcibiades' enemies blamed him and his youthful gang of friends for the mutilation of the Hermes and the profanation of the mysteries. The Athenians viewed impiety very seriously, as I said. This is still an age when traditional orthodoxy prevailed. And the people believed that it was essential for the well-being of the state to remain in the god's favour. And so Alcibiades faced a severe penalty, even death, if he was found guilty. He immediately demanded to be tried, but an assembly debated the matter, and that assembly could not find any evidence against him. So it was decided to let him sail with the fleet. So after all of these shenanigans, the great fleet set sail. After it picked up more ships and men from allies as it sailed to a stopping off point at Corcyra, the armada, as it sailed across the Mediterranean, consisted of 134 triremes and around 25,000 soldiers. And these were supported by 130 ships carrying supplies. Now this is an enormous force. It's enough to take on half a dozen Sicilies. It crossed the Mediterranean and it put in at Rhegium in southern Italy, only a stone's throw from Sicily. And there it was discovered that the Egestans had lied about their wealth, that they were unable, after all, to pay for the cost of the expedition. Now, this was a massive blow, because as Thucydides says, this fleet was the most expensive ever put together. To make matters worse, the three commanders couldn't agree on a plan of action for some time. Nicias advised going to the aid of Egesta against Salinas in keeping with the original intent of the mission, and then going home. Alcibiades wanted to try to win over as many Sicilian cities as possible, with a view to taking on Syracuse. Lamachus, on the other hand, was in favour of attacking Syracuse now, before the Syracusans could properly deploy their own considerable fleet. Now, Lamachus is very much the junior member of this trio. He seems to have been disregarded all the time. And so when nobody listened to him, he threw in his support to Alcibiades. But it's about this time that Alcibiades was recalled to Athens to stand trial for his alleged role in the mutilation of the Hermes and the profanation of the mysteries. Clearly, his enemies had found it easier to disparage him when he'd left Athens.